If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. This is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Alrighty, round two. Eve Engler, Montreal-based activist, is coming up. He's been on my podcast and on my TNT program before. I should have him on more often. It's been quite a while, but he does great analysis on empire and Canada's role in the empire that often goes underlooked. And he's hilarious. He's just nonstop. He's going to these events with these Canadian politicians and calling them out to their face. I mean, kudos to him. It's being reported, Financial Times, that outraged and furious, Germans rebel against gas boiler ban. They take as an example Frank Krusch, who says he's not against heat pumps in principle. It's just there's a small problem. To install one, he would have to knock down his entire house and build a new house. He says they only work in low energy houses and mine isn't. To make it truly energy efficient, you'd have to rebuild the whole shell, including the roof. The only reason he's even having to contemplate such drastic action as bulldozing his house and rebuilding it for a boiler. I mean, how cartoonish can you get? Because of a German government bill that in effect bans new gas boilers in Germany from January 1st next year. That's in 6 months. To the day, 6 months exactly, I think. From then on, newly installed heating systems would have to be at least 65% powered by renewables. So the bill has triggered a popular backlash of exceptional intensity. Germans are worried about the enormous cost of switching from gas or oil-fired boilers to heat pumps and the deadlines, the tight deadlines the bill imposes. People are outraged and furious. Hey, welcome to the Green World Order, to the new Middle Ages, neo-feudalism. None of this is a problem for the elites. It's just to get rid of the middle class, that's all. So we're just going to have the plebs, serfs, and the aristocracy. So that's going on. And, some algorithm ghetto news, Adobe tool. There's a new Adobe tool to stamp out misinformation being added directly to modern cameras. This is insane. A transparency report from Adobe about how it plans to cooperate with Australia's code of practice on disinfo and misinformation, Ministry of Truth, has revealed the extent to which its new rollout of technology that embeds data in images in order to curb misinformation is faring. They made a partnership with Nikon and Leica to bring image marking technology to Nikon's Z9 and Leica M11 cameras. The technology will increase trust in photographers. It's all about trust capital, isn't it? I talked about that with Robert Blumen a while back. Increase trust in photographers' digital work by securing provenance information at the point of capture, including location, time, and how the image was taken. So what, like you won't have a choice anymore if you got one of these cameras? It's going to tell everybody exactly your location, like where you took it, the location, time, and how the image was taken. Provenance is the facts of a piece of digital content like origin. It's crazy. Like you won't even have the freedom anymore, when it comes to taking photos. It's all going to be like Minority Report and tracked and... I mean, this is next level crazy. This is next level crazy. And Amazon backs the digital euro. Amazon said that the controversial digital euro would add value and increase innovation. But of course, Amazon may be somewhat biased since the ECB tasked Amazon with building a digital euro prototype for application in e-commerce. So onward with the cyber gulag. Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, has claimed the West is preparing a coup in Belarus. No doubt they've been attempting that. They keep attempting it. He has accused Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine of training armed extremist groups to infiltrate the country. They're not extremist groups. They are moderate rebels, okay? They're not terrorists or extremists. They are moderate rebels. And yeah, we saw that during COVID. You know, IMF, World Bank said, take all this money. And if you do, you got to force everyone to get injected and wear masks and lock down. And then Luki is like, nah, you're crazy. We're not going to do that. Next thing you know, there was an attempt at a regime change, which failed. That's going on in Belarus. And we've got Chinese scientists have begun drilling a 10,000 meter hole into the Earth's crust as the world's second largest economy explores new frontiers above and below. As above, so below. How's it go? Crowley's maxim. Below the planet's surface. So are they trying to, you know, when I was a kid, they said, like, what was it? Like, if you dig a hole deep enough, you'll end up in China. Is China trying to make that a reality? Fascinating. I remember, I think the country, the Soviets got the furthest in drilling deep into the earth. But I read about that it just became nearly impossible in terms of the technology and the drill. It's extremely difficult. And one more update. Hans Christensen, nuclear expert who's very liberal globalist. Nonetheless, I still follow him because he's got useful info. He says there's been a lot happening on the northern flank. Finland joined NATO. Sweden is next. Largest ever air exercise. First U.S. aircraft carrier visit to Oslo in 65 years. Iceland opens ports to nuclear subs. NATO foreign ministers meet in Norway and increasing defense spending. And one more. Hungary is again blackmailed by Brussels because of its anti-war position. That's coming from Balázs Orbán, political director of Orbán's political director. So there's a lot going on. All right. A reminder for a complete list of shows and the TNT schedule, just go to tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction, truth from lies and propaganda. We try our best right here on TNT Radio.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA, it's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Even Nazis have inalienable rights, as reprehensible as their ideology might be. At least that's what a Dresden higher regional court judge reportedly said during the trial of a 28-year-old female German student and three accomplices who have been found guilty of carrying out a string of attacks on members of Germany's neo-Nazi scene, one of the most high-profile trials of a group of militant leftists since the days of the Bader-Meinhof group. Here with the story, joining me now is TNT Radio News producer Adam Clark, codename Ruckus.
Thanks, Corey. Boy, that sounded like a mouthful. Sorry about that. All right. So this is fascinating to me. This is a very interesting story, I think. So the woman, the 28-year-old female German student, that is, who in keeping with Germany's strict privacy laws, well, was and will from now on only be referred to as Lena E. Okay. She was sentenced on Wednesday to 5 years and 3 months in prison amid chaotic scenes in a court in Dresden, Eastern Germany, according to The Guardian. Three co-accused men between ages between 28 and 37 were given sentences ranging from 2 years and 5 months to 3 years and 3 months over either membership of or support for a criminal organization. At least five more members of the, here we go, anti-neo-Nazi network. That's right. These are anti-neo-Nazis, as long as you've got that. All right. So at least five more of these people, including Lena E's partner, they describe whoever this person is, are believed to be at large and continuing to operate underground, with a report by Germany's criminal police office attesting the group displayed levels of professionalism last seen in the days of the Red Army faction. Colloquially, I hate that word, colloquially known as the Bader-Meinhof Group. The Red Army faction was a militant left-wing urban guerrilla network that carried out explosives attacks and assassinations in Western Germany from 1970 to the early 90s. Many of its members have since vanished and never faced trial. Now, the rap sheet here against Lena E. and her accomplices listed six violent attacks in the eastern states of Thuringia and Saxony between August 2018 and the summer of 2020 that wound up injuring 13 people, two of them in a life-threatening manner. Excuse me, two in a life-threatening manner. The victims were mostly well-known right-wing extremists or people the group perceived to be thus. Leon R., a barkeeper who was charged earlier this month with forming a right-wing extremist outfit, was attacked with hammers, clubs, and pepper spray at his bar in the town of Eisenach in late 2019. In at least one case, the victim's ideological affiliation seemed to have been less clear. Masked attackers beat up a 31-year-old in Leipzig's Connewitz district in January 2019 because because he wore a black hat by Greifvogel, a German clothing brand, which just happens to be popular in right-wing neo-Nazi extremist circles. In court, the man described the hat as a gift from a friend and insisted that he had long ago turned his back on a neo-Nazi scene he had once belonged to as a teenager. During the trial, which started in September 2021, Castle-born Lena E. became a modern icon in German left-wing and anarchist circles. The graffitied slogan, quote-unquote, Free Lena, is a regular sighting on buildings in Berlin, Hamburg, and Leipzig. Now, scenes at the Dresden court were ruckus, from the moment Lena E. entered the room, with about 100 supporters cheering her appearance from the galleries and the judge having to appeal for quiet to read his reasoning. Some of the group's supporters in the gallery heckled fascist friends, voicing the allegation that the German justice system has in the past been willfully blind when considering right-wing militants' crimes. The judge himself appeared to acknowledge, quote-unquote, deplorable deficiencies in trials in which neo-Nazi supporters have been let off lightly. He described right-wing extremism as posing the greater threat to the country, but said even Nazis had inalienable rights, as reprehensible as their ideology may be. His verdict against the main accused was more lenient than the 8 years in prison called for by the prosecutor. Wow. Nonetheless, left-wing groups have called for protests against the ruling on Saturday. And indeed, it went down, Harbori. According to ABC News, they said that according to the police in Leipzig, around 800 people gathered in the city, and it looks like it got very raucous indeed. We'll have to keep an eye on this. What do you think?
I mean, I think just across the board rules should apply for everyone. You know, there shouldn't be violence of right against left or left against right. And, you know, what you mentioned, these violent attacks in the summer of 2020 that injured 13, including life, two of them life-threatening manner. I mean, it doesn't matter who the victims are, if they're well-known right-wing extremists or left-wing extremists or whatever, you know, X-type extremists. If the targets are not being violent, there's no, you know, these are just universal rules. So, you know, I think if that's what they did, that's, you know, that's what they should get. But again, I think we often have to remind ourselves that the nonviolence is the way to go. Again, always using nonviolence as the most effective approach. And, you know, that's why the U.S. uses color revolutions all across the planet. You know, Gene Sharp of the Albert Einstein Institute, that model they developed has been the most successful. We saw Martin Luther King, you know, Gandhi, of course, and Martin Luther King Jr. You know, he was about to bring 500,000 people to the White House, nonviolently, peacefully, anti-war, civil rights. And there was just no way the government could stop it. No way. They had to put a bullet in his head and take him out. You know, he forced them to do that. So there's no reason, I think, as you know, this story you portrayed, to get violent at all with anyone. That's just crazy. It's nonsense. And violence is like the cheap way of trying to make change. And you know, there are many. It's a bit more complicated. You got to sit down, you know, when it comes to affecting change through a nonviolent manner. But you got to get a bit more creative. But you know, there's you can use sarcasm. You can use again protests. But I guess you know, it is what it is. Ruckus, your final thoughts.
I guess now is not a good time to let you know about this other story I was reading on Al Jazeera today. There was this group of Haitian vigilantes. They have no choice because they're being they're suffering a large amount of killings, rapes, kidnappings related to gangs. So a group of people decided to get together and say enough is enough, and they armed themselves with machetes, and they've been doing the most horrible things, chasing down these other. I mean, the people they're killing are killers, but it's definitely an eye for an eye. That it says they've been chased, beaten, decapitated, and then burned alive, the gang members, to try to scare away all the other criminals. I don't know, man. Pretty wild stuff.
Well, that's a whole different scenario. You're defending yourself from killers and rapists. In that case, you know, when my home was first broken in, when I came to Mexico in 2010, I was living not in a gated community. My home was broken into three times. And I seriously considered, you know, obtaining a firearm and sitting on my couch all night with the lights off and waiting for them to break into my home a fourth time, and, you know, having them turn on the lights and seeing me on the couch sitting there with a gun, like, hey, guys, and, you know, shooting them. And so I have no qualms at all when it comes to defending your home and when, you know, when things are out of control at that level. But, you know, the previous, I think, example, if the right wingers were not getting violent and vice versa, then you shouldn't be going at them with hammers or right wingers versus leftists and stuff like that. So anyways, we got a great guest back on from Canada, Eve Engler, Montreal-based activist and author. Feel free to call in and talk with us as well. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio's Alan Miller.
Let's get those interest rates up. Let's get those impositions on people. Let's not have a solution to productivity. Well, they're all at it. The Bank of England doing the same old thing again and again. The International Monetary Fund, the organization with the biggest flaws and fatalities to its record and name, weighing in a bit like they all did when they had the coup against the elected representatives who did try and change things or did not win the public over to their arguments. They said the markets wouldn't put up with it. And here we are again, Groundhog Day. What are their solutions? Raise interest rates. We've had some more quantitative easing, haven't we? Printing money, the magic money tree. And in America, we're seeing this big discussion about whether the debt ceiling's going to be raised. What's it going to mean for us all? Where's the public within all of this? What about our needs, our interests?
Alan Miller and today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Radio works because of its ability to personalize to the listener.
What's exciting these days is that people are rediscovering it. You know, people are really rediscovering just how powerful radio is, how ubiquitous it is. It's in our cars, it's in our homes. There are so many new ways to access it. It's everywhere.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live. We don't talk at you.
Blah, 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 blah.
Shut up! We talk with you.
What do you think of this idea?
Let me tell you this.
What's wrong with this picture?
From government overreach to the global pandemic, TNT Radio invites you to join us as we separate facts from fiction, truth from propaganda, day in, day out. Call the open line anytime. From the U.S. and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech has a home on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Back on the program is Eve Engler, Montreal-based activist and author. He's written numerous books, including Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada and a Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War. You can find all of his stuff at eveengler.com. That's YVESENGLER.com. On Twitter, at Engler Eve. Welcome back to TNT, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
I've been enjoying your work lately, your activism getting in the face of all these Canadian politicians and warmongers. But maybe before getting to that, for me, most interesting in terms of some of your latest analysis is you did a piece on Mongolia shows Canadian foreign policy dominated by mining companies. And that hits home with me because I used to live in Mongolia. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. At one point, I was intermediate in the Mongolian language. I absolutely love Mongolia and the Mongolian people. I lived in the Gobi Desert in a yurt for over a year. Absolutely loved it. And, you know, I think Rio Tinto was one of the big companies there. And they've always been these problems. And I think they were taking advantage of Mongolia and the Mongolian government. I read a report that Mongolia has over $1 trillion in terms of minerals and resources. And I think that if that got divided to all of the population, that would be, someone calculated, $300,000 plus per citizen. But and then I think you or some others have also been commentating on this same problem in Latin America as well when it comes to mining. So, you know, just your thoughts on, you know, the mining issues and the Canadian mining companies just extracting wealth from these countries.
Well, Canada is the hub of global mining. More than half of the world's mining companies are listed in Canada or have their offices based here, even though Canada is less than 0.5% of the world population. And in the case of Mongolia, that article just traces how Canadian diplomatic relations with Mongolia were literally set up at the behest of Ivanhoe, which was later bought out by Rio Tinto, but a Canadian mining company and their well-known CEO, Robert Freeland, basically because there was lots of protests back in 2006, thereabouts, there were big protests against the Canadian operated mine. And the mining company wanted more diplomatic support. And so they were able to convince the Canadian government to set up initially a trade office, then an embassy. And right up until today, the Canadian aid funding in Mongolia, Mongolia was made a priority country for Canadian aid. And there's a recent academic article that basically shows that the Canadian officials tell the academic that, like, everything they do in the country is really designed for Canadian mining interests, and that all the aid is designed to basically lessen the government's willingness to put restrictions on the Canadian mine, get more better royalties for the government from the mining operations. And the Mongolia example is an extreme example, but recently in Mexico, for instance, there's been a mining reform that. Progressive mining reform to weaken the dominance of foreign mining companies, slight improvement on some of the ecological questions. And the Canadian government is openly criticizing the Mexican government for adopting those reforms. So around the world, in dozens and dozens of countries in the world, the primary thing that Canadian diplomats do, and even Canadian aid is about, is advancing the interests of Canadian mining companies and their extraction of profits.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's sad, really, how they just take advantage of these countries and just extract most of the wealth while the local countries get very little. And it's funny, I'm noticing in the article, you cite Julian Derkes, a professor at the Institute of Asian Research at UBC. And he's been a guest of mine on my podcast. And I actually tried to get him on at TNT, but he was ill at the time and in another part of the world. So small world there. And real quick, and maybe just on the Mexico point. Yeah, Mexico's been taking more charge of its energy sovereignty, taking charge of its lithium. And we're seeing Latin America, they want to form like a regional Latin American grouping when it comes to lithium and energy. And maybe real quick, I can't keep track of all of the times that you're going to these different events with Canadian politicians. Now, you recently were, I think one of your most interesting ones that I saw recently was where you say that RCMP just tossed me from presser for asking Veterans Affairs Minister McCulley whether Canada sending $2 billion in arms to fight Russia while calling for regime change in Moscow. And I think you got kicked out of that. If you want to just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, at this point, the local RCMP is pretty aware of me. So I have to be a little bit more stealth when I try to go into the different press conferences. And in that case, I showed up very late. I was able to get inside the press conference. And then I always try to get as close to the front as possible, because if they're going to try to take you out, it's much more difficult for them when you're close to everyone else and make their life as difficult as possible. And an RCMP agent came and stood next to me. So I immediately moved up towards an empty seat right close to the front. And then the RCMP agent came right next to me there. But I was able to sort of like position myself close to the minister, who didn't recognize me, and ask him a quick question about basically, you know, are we using Ukrainians as the cannon fodder in our, primarily US, led bid to weaken Russia? And, the Veterans Affairs Minister, listened to my question and then basically just talked about how we're there to support democracy. He just, you know, went to the talking points. And then when I tried to follow up with a question about what, you know, whether our policy of helping to overthrow Ukraine's government in 2014 and pushing NATO expansion and undermine the Minsk Accord, whether that was about democracy, the minister kind of walked away and the RCMP agent pushed me out of the press conference. But these are the basic objective here is that these are questions mostly to do with foreign policy that the Canadian media just completely ignores. And the whole model of how the politicians work is they try to control everything, right? They try to control like every kind of question that can be asked. And they have all their different ways of sort of effectively vetting who can ask questions. And so what I do is I try to just go as where I can. I try to, when I find out about the events, try to go into the room and get as close to the politician and ask the question. And sometimes you'll find that these politicians really they'll squirm when you ask the question and they don't have any response. And sometimes they just go right into talking points. And sometimes they just completely ignore you. And sometimes they just try to get their flax or the security to kick you out. But from a standpoint of social media, it's, I think, a somewhat effective way of getting sort of some critical messages circulating.
Yeah, that last point you made, I mean, you really are able to point out just very clearly in black and white their hypocrisy. I think maybe next time you should maybe grow a beard, get a wig, to better disguise yourself. We're going to have to jump to the headlines with James. Go.
What the hell is this?
Breaking news.
TNT Radio News.
Breaking news. Breaking news.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. House Republicans say they plan to move forward with a contempt of Congress vote as soon as next week against FBI Director Christopher Wray. Canada is set to become the first country in the world to require tobacco companies to print health warning labels directly on individual cigarettes in a bid to make more Canadians quit smoking. Glasgow has become the first Scottish city to enforce a low emission zone that will see drivers fined if their cars do not meet the standards.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
We're talking to Yves Engler, Montreal-based activist and author. I highly recommend his books. He covers Canadian foreign policy. I've used his books as assigned reading for some of my students in international relations, undergrads here in Mexico when I used to teach. I think I even Skyped you into one of our classes once. But you mentioned how the RCMP already knows you, and I'm not sure if you're up to speed with the recent story regarding Gray Zone journalist Kit Klarenberg, who's had also been a guest of mine on my podcast. He's based in Serbia, but he went back to the UK recently, and the UK counterterrorism officers interrogated him for 5 hours, took his electronic devices and, you know, downloaded the material, forced DNA swabs upon him. He's just a reporter. And what really hit home was retired diplomat Craig Murray posted about this. And he said, quote, "To be a dissident in the UK, or indeed the West, today is to see every single day your friends persecuted and to see the walls close in upon yourself. A unified political class controlled by billionaires is hurtling us towards fascism that now seems to me undeniable," end quote. And that's exactly how I feel. You know, any thoughts on, if you're familiar with Clarenberg's recent adventures, or, you know, what Craig Murray said, or just this general trend in the West?
Well, I saw the story about Kit. It's pretty scary stuff. It seems pretty outrageous. And I've also seen that some people posting on Twitter that don't expect The Guardian or, you know, any of the British media to cover it, because he's writing stories that make the powerful uncomfortable, and including the liberal end of the dominant media. I know I saw it was under some legislation that they adopted that just gives incredible power to the authorities. Obviously, we saw in the States the African People Socialist Party was that about 6 weeks ago or something like that, where a couple of their activists were like indicted for potentially, I think, for like 10 years or something like that, accusing them of being tied to Russia or something to that effect. It's pretty disturbing. If you look at, like, you know, here, Canada hasn't been the same examples of the imprisonment around challenging the NATO proxy war, but the whole ethos, I just over the weekend, there's a second event that I was supposed to be speaking at with a University of Montreal prof and the head of the Green Party in Quebec, and two different community centers. Over a 6 week period, book the room and then ban the room. And now this weekend, there's another event in Toronto that another group's putting on, that there's a whole campaign to shut down. And all this is kind of framed under the lens of like disinformation, or, you know, pro Russia disinformation kind of angle. Obviously, in the UK, in an even more extreme example, Julian Assange has been, you know, rotting away in prison now for however many years for doing a great service to humanity. So, you know, there are all kinds of subtle ways of excluding critical kind of reporting and critical activism, and then there's also these very open and repressive ways, and we're seeing examples, more and more examples of those very open and repressive means being asserted.
Yeah, it's just insane what's going on, as you mentioned, with Julian Assange, and again, this trend is just continuing. And maybe as a segue into getting your thoughts on the whole Ukraine situation, this was back in March, so 3 months ago, you did another great, I don't know what you call it, you asked Canada's sports minister about this ban against Russian and Belarusian athletes from sports competitions. And again, I mean, what you asked is factual and objective, and you asked whether she felt the same way about U.S. athletes, or I guess Canadians, after U.S. invaded Iraq and Libya was bombed. I mean, you're right. You know, you American athletes should be banned because of that, and Canadian, you know, or you also mentioned Israel, and she smirked and walked away. And again, you're very good at pointing out these double standards. They always say the international rules-based order, but there's two sets of rules. And, you know, this exceptionalism, it's just, it never stops bugging me. Your further thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, the double standards are just totally crass. And that intervention with Canada's sports minister was how she reacted to it exposed how crass the double standards are, in that she accepted the question, even though her staff were trying to usher her out. And then when the question was asked, she really had no answer, and she just literally just smirked and walked away. And I followed her for about a minute trying to ask variations of the same question. And there's no answer. There is no answer. I'm clear. I think Russia's invasion is contrary to international law. I think it's brutal. I see the images from Ukraine, and obviously look at Bakhmut, and there's just how many young men, or not even young men, but just mostly men on both sides have died. It seems all totally insane that in 2023, we would just be destroying, humans would be destroying other humans in that way. It's all, you know, totally horrible. I think what Russia's done needs to be condemned, but there is a context. There is a context of provocation. There's a context of low-level proxy war that Canada was in with Russia dating back to 2015 when we started training the Ukrainian forces fighting against other Ukrainians in the east of the country who were, to some extent at least, backed by Russia. And what Russia did 15 months ago was massively expand this low-level proxy war that had been going on. And now what the Canadian government is doing and what the U.S. government is doing is not trying to end the horrors, but rather to prolong it and to pump in more weapons, pump in more intelligence support, because they see this as a way to weaken a geopolitical competitor and to use Ukrainians to basically fight Russia. And so I think that it's imperative that people in Canada and the US do what they can to pressure the politicians to support the initiatives from countries like Brazil, China, South Africa, six African countries, the Pope, Turkey at different points, even Israel was involved in some of the earlier negotiations to end that, have a truce and move towards peace negotiations. And, there's no good solution coming out of the, the situation is so horrible. And I think both sides, there's so much Russophobia, both sides are, committed to fighting at this point. Probably it isn't realistic to get a truce or peace negotiations tomorrow, but you have to start somewhere. You have to start by talking about it. You have to start by not escalating further. And what we've been doing is just both sides have just been escalating each step of the way. And that still has the potential to escalate to something even more horrific than what we're seeing. I think it's a devastating situation, obviously, primarily for Ukrainians, also for Russians secondarily, but also there's all kinds of negative geopolitical implications all around the world of this this terrible conflict, and it needs to end.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone should agree on that, but something you highlight from the Canadian angle are these, special interests, the Canadian military-industrial complex. We got, the American military-industrial complex, and just so many of these interests making a pile of money. And, I think last time when you were on TNT late last year, we talked about Haiti. Then I had you on my podcast, and my eye was open to what you discussed. Again, this is often overlooked. Canada has this, we've talked about this before, this image of being this sort of like peacenik, but you had explained that the Canadian military was key in training the Ukrainian soldiers and Canada is a key node in this Ukraine war. And you've been writing recently about the CAE, largest Canadian headquartered military firm. You also recently wrote a piece on the truth about Canadian aid policy being revealed in the briefing notes. If you want to just tell us more about you know, Canada's skin in the game in Ukraine?
Yeah, well, Canada has been a big proponent of NATO expansion for, you know, and creation. And one of the, going back to before it was created in 1949, but a big proponent of NATO expansion over the past three decades since the end of the Soviet Union. And part of that is because, you know, NATO expansion was designed to benefit the U.S. military industrial complex. Canada has, since the Defense Production Sharing Arrangement of 1956, Canadian arms firms have a special deal where they get to sell to the Pentagon as if they are part, as if they are American firms. So what happens in effect is that Canadian arms companies provide components to huge number of American weapon systems. And so when American military companies in the mid-1990s set up the initiative to promote NATO expansion, because they saw having more Eastern European countries part of NATO as being, you know, increasing the arms export market for them, Canadian companies were you know, major beneficiaries of that. In the case of CAE, CAE is an example of it's the biggest Canadian based. Most of the big Canadian arms companies are actually American companies. So like General Dynamics Canada, Lockheed Martin Canada, they often have major, they're not just branch plants. They have major research operations in Canada as well. And sometimes they employ as many as like 10,000 Canadians. And they're, you know, deeply tied into the whole political and cultural and academic kind of worlds. So Canadian companies are very much benefit and CAE from American militarism, NATO expansion, and CAE is a specific example where most of what CAE does is it trains pilots all around the world, primarily actually American pilots. They have major operations all across the U.S. They train Israeli, Saudi, UAE, all in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So Canada has a very significant arms industry that exports billions of dollars in weapons each year, principally to the U.S., but also to Saudi Arabia and European countries. And obviously, the whole NATO proxy war, there's been, you know, more than $2 billion in Canadian weapons that have been delivered to Ukraine over the past 15 months. And that's obviously good for arms companies. And so that goes on. And, you know, the story I wrote about the aid minister, that was an example where Canada, the international development minister, when he was in Qatar back in November during the World Cup, he was told by the Global Affairs staff, the Global Affairs Canada staff, in a briefing note, was a key item that he was supposed to push was arms sales for a Canadian light armored vehicle sale deal to Qatar. So you have this idea of this, like, you know, development minister going and, you know, helping to build wells for people who don't water or help girls go to school and impoverished places. But in fact, what he's doing is, in this instance at least, is, you know, promoting arms sales to a monarchy. Kind of hard to align that with what most people think of as international development. Now, with regards to Ukraine and the Operation Unifier, which is the Canada's training mission, this is a really important part. This is actually quite an important part, not just, you know, for Canada, but in the whole story of what's going on today in Ukraine. And
can you just hold that thought, the Ukraine training mission? We got to jump to our break. And again, the website is eveengler.com. He's got a whole host of books. I highly recommend I get it. I've used them in my as assigned reading for my students in IR class. So I think the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy and so many more. Follow Eve as well on Twitter at Engler Eve. Call in if you want as well. We'll be right back.
Red alert! The World Health Organization is once again pushing their global pandemic treaty, but some European elected officials are fighting back. You'll want to hear this.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Croatian Member of Parliament Mislav Kolazukak spoke for all freedom-loving citizens of the world when he said the following this week.
It will be healthier and safer for humanity to sign agreement with the Colombian drug cartel. They know all about drugs for sure. During the COVID pandemic, World Health Organization only told lies.
Bravo to this Croatian member of parliament. Bravo! Let's not forget that the World Health Organization is funded by the number one funder, Bill Gates, a close second, the United States government, and the WHO is beholden to China and pushed Chinese-style lockdowns on the world. We cannot live in a world where Bill Gates-funded scientists at the WHO declare global instant lockdowns. We must now start the Great Reject. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
One kind thing, like giving us the clothes you don't wear anymore,
gets me a wheelchair and my independence back.
One kind thing, like raising money with a bake sale,
gives us comfort, food, and a warm smile after floods destroyed our home.
One kind thing, like challenging yourself to a sponsored cycle,
helps me sleep soundly, knowing my children have clean drinking water.
Choose your one kind thing and help change someone's world. Search British Red Cross today.
Hear about it.
And I don't understand the American people.
Talk about it.
I shouldn't have to just swallow what you're giving me.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
It's our last segment with Montreal-based activist author Eve Engler. Get his books. Subscribe to his email list, eveengler.com. Shout out to Dennis in the interactive chat, who said he's grateful for finding TNT Radio. Welcome to the club. And I just got to laugh at Mark Morano's pronunciation of my fellow countryman, Mislav. He said, Kolazukak. No, it's Mislav Kolakušić. So nice try, though, Mark. Nice try. we learned by our mistakes. That was just funny. But sorry we interrupted you. Eve, you were talking about the Ukraine's training mission.
Yeah, so basically after Canada helped oust Viktor Yanukovych, elected president in 2014, obviously it led to conflict in the east, a civil war, effectively. And in April of 2015, the Canadian government instigated a major training mission for a military. You know, basically the Ukrainian military sort of collapsed after Yanukovych was ousted, and they had to, you know, sort of use sort of right-wing militias to fight in the east. And so basically the Canadian government began this big training mission and trained more than 33,000 Ukrainian troops. And Petro Poroshenko, the former Ukrainian president post Maidan, he called Jason Kenney, the Canadian minister who instigated the Operation Unifier, the training mission, he called him the godfather of the modern Ukrainian military. And at the time when Operation Unifier was instigated, the Russian embassy in Ottawa was, you know, put out a statement saying that this was designed to undermine the Minsk II peace accord, which was signed in February of 2015. So Operation Unifier began 2 months later, and that it would basically just embolden those forces in Kyiv that didn't want to fulfill their obligations under Minsk II, which the French and Germans had overseen and the United Nations Security Council had adopted, but of course, you know, Washington and London and Ottawa didn't really want that, and so we started this big training mission, and with time that just kept growing, right? More, you had the Canadian training forces went further and further. You know, they were sort of getting closer to the front line. Initially, they were only in Western Ukraine. Then you had Canadian Special Forces that joined in. And then the Americans in 2017, 2018 began sending significant weapons. And Canada then brought in other measures to bring Ukraine as a country that could be, Canadian company could sell weapons to. And so, you know, that's an important piece in understanding what happened, you know, when Russia, you know, invaded 15 months ago, and the Canadian government's reaction, you know, they initially put Operation Unifier on pause for a little bit just before Russia's invasion, but then they restarted it back in August, and they've actually increased it. Now there's more Canadians training Ukrainians. Now there's Canadians training Ukrainians in Poland, in Latvia, and in the UK. And it's all part of the escalation, you know, process, right? It's just like each step, we just, you know, Russia does something, we go back, do something, they go back, they escalate, we escalate. It's not learning the lessons, right? Like the recent piece I wrote, you know, is trying to point out that we had, you know, the past of how we got here and how something like Operation Unifier played a role into you know, provoking the tensions that we're seeing that are leading to these horrors in Ukraine. We have to understand that if we don't understand that, these horrors are just going to keep going and going and going, and maybe, you know, get to something even worse. So the Canadian training, and I guess, you know, the other part, I mean, this Ukraine example is probably the most egregious example, but if you go actually throughout history, Canadian training, you know, just like the U.S., military training is used to exert influence, often in countries in the global south, in having security forces that are aligned with the Canadian government. And you mentioned Haiti earlier. Haiti's a prime example of that, where Canadian police training and military training over the years has been about basically asserting U.S.-Canadian power in that country and elsewhere.
Yeah, I would just add, as you mentioned, the threat of escalation. There's a lot of smart people more and more discussing this. You know, John Robb, who does Global Guerrillas report, very interesting. He says the U.S. nuclear force has been geared for counter-value strikes, first strike capability. This puts Russia in an unstable use-it-or-lose-it situation, because to have any nukes left, they must fire them on early warning. Our proxy, Ukraine, is now bombing Moscow with waves of drones and cruise missiles. What could go wrong? So it's scary. And I guess this sort of leads to another question about multipolarity. I think I saw you comment on it today. Indeed, there was a BRICS meeting. India's foreign minister, I believe, Jai Shankar, said, "Our gathering must send out a strong message that the world is multipolar. Lula is calling to drop the dollar, create a regional South American currency. Cuba's president echoed the same." I feel like the train is riding, the momentum is building. There's no stopping this. So, you know, your thoughts on multipolarity?
Well, I obviously support weakening U.S. Hegemony, and you know, weakening the dollar hegemony is a very good thing. It's totally ridiculous. You know, I've traveled in Eastern Africa, and it's totally ridiculous that, you know, exchange between Uganda and Kenya is done in U.S. dollars. That makes no sense. And obviously, you know, what Lula said recently about, you know, the trade with, why is trade between Brazil and Argentina happening in U.S. dollars? So that's good. And I think that there has been some weakening in the dollar. The dollar still is the dominant currency by a large margin. I actually saw a statistic, probably a little bit dated now, but that there was actually more international trade in the Canadian dollar than there was in the in Chinese currency, which is, you know, completely remarkable considering how small Canada is next to China. That's probably changed in the last few years, but I think so. Obviously, all the initiatives like UNOSUR, BRICS, these are good initiatives. I don't see, I see BRICS as breaking U.S. dominance, but I don't see it as necessarily, you know, the more kind of socialistic type of initiative, like maybe something like ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance that the Venezuelan government set up in the mid 2000s. That both had a important geopolitical component, but also in terms of breaking away from U.S. dominance, and also a more sort of socialistic element. But yeah, so obviously multipolarity. I'm a little skeptical of some people who are arguing that, you know, what happens, you know, who controls the Donbass in 2 years from now, that has a big impact on multipolarity. I don't know that actually does matter that much, quite frankly, for either side, either Russia or NATO. I think that there's a somewhat of an exaggeration of the geopolitical dimension, maybe on that, some things like that. But definitely, you know, weakening and that's happening. You're totally right in that, you know, the G7, the BRICS economies are basically, you know, they're on par with the G7 and so they should be. And I think one principle that is important is that, you know, the biggest countries, the countries that have the most people, India and China, they should be the most powerful. If we believe in equality, the countries that have most people should be the most powerful. So the idea that a country like the U.S. with 330 million people, that it's the most powerful, that should be in the, you know, dustbin of history.
We are out of time. I had wanted to ask you about your thoughts on Chrystia Freeland attending Bilderberg recently. Maybe she'll be the next prime minister of Canada. We'll save that for next time, as well as Roger Waters and Israel. Thanks for coming back on TNT, Eve Engler. The website is eveengler.com. Get his books. Follow him on Twitter at @Engler_Eve. And stay tuned. Steve Malzberg is up next.